This is Thinkinclusive. I'm Tim Villegas. Okay, I want to talk to all the teachers listening, especially special education teachers. How many of you work with occupational therapists in your school or in your classroom? Let's just get a show of hands. Just raise your hand or give me a nod. Great, great. Thank you. I see you in your car, you taking a walk, and you drinking your coffee. Aren't OTs wonderful? Let's all give it up for OTs. There we go. You know, April is OT month. I know, right? Now, how many of you can explain what an OT does? If you said fine motor or independent feeding skills, this episode is going to blow your mind. This week's guest, Savitha Sundar. She gives the best explanation of the role of occupational therapists I have ever heard. And you're going to hear it right after this short break. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Savitha Sundar is an occupational therapist and PhD candidate who specializes in inclusive practices for students with extensive support needs. With over 15 years in public schools, she's a champion for inclusive education, leveraging her OT experience to foster access and participation. At Texas Women's University, she mentors future OTs and teaches as an adjunct faculty member. Savitha also serves as the partnerships officer at Changing Perspectives, promoting social emotional learning. She also hosts the podcast Inclusive Occupations, inspiring the creation of inclusive communities for children and youth with disabilities. In this episode of Think Inclusive, Savitha and I delve into the nuances of including students with extensive support needs into general education. Savitha unpacks her transition from a traditional understanding of educational practices to pioneering inclusive education methodologies, her commitment to nurturing social contexts that facilitate the engagement and growth of children with disabilities shines through as she retells experiences that reshaped her professional trajectory. Leveraging her background as an occupational therapist, Savitha passionately argues for a system-wide approach where therapists go beyond addressing motor skills to facilitate comprehensive participation and inclusion within educational settings, making her a vital voice in the call for an educational paradigm shift. Before we dive into our conversation with Savitha, I want to share a word from this week's sponsor. With 1 in 36 children diagnosed with autism, the Autism Society of America is dedicated to creating connections, empowering everyone in the autism community with the resources needed to live fully. As the nation's oldest leading grassroots autism organization, the Autism Society and its approximately 70 affiliates serve over 500,000 people each year by championing initiatives that advance equitable opportunities in healthcare, education, employment, safety, and public policy. The organization executes a national reach with meaningful local impact. Through education, advocacy, support, and community programming, the Autism Society works toward a world in which everyone is connected to the support they need when they need it. For more information, go to autismsociety.org. The connection is you. And now, my conversation with Savitha Sundar. Savitha Sundar, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Of course. How long have we known each other, Savitha? It's been a while.
Yeah.
And I want to say right off the bat that Savitha has a wonderful podcast called Inclusive Occupations. Did I get it right?
Yep. You did.
That's no notes. That's right off the top of my head. And so after you listen to this episode, go ahead and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to Savitha's, because she has some great guests. And to start us off, I'd love to know, you know, everyone kind of gets on the road to inclusive education a little differently. So what started you on the road to inclusive education?
Sure, yeah. So I am an occupational therapist by trade. And I've been an OT since 2001, I guess. So it's been a long time. And I always wanted to work in pediatric practice with children. So I sort of took all courses in that space and took up a job in pediatrics and school-based practice in Arkansas, and then moved around and ended up in California in 2008 when I started working in the school system. And I was hired by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, and I worked with them for 13 years. And during the course of my practice as an OT in the school. So the County Office of Education is where I should say they helped me grow my roots in this space. And I worked predominantly with students with extensive support needs, or I should say exclusively with students with extensive support needs. And this is way back many years ago So the way the schools were set up in the Bay Area, California, in Santa Clara County, which is the Silicon Valley, is that the school districts are, many school districts are very tiny. Some are big, some are tiny. But when they are unable to provide FAPE, fair and appropriate public education, they would seek help from the county, which was like a third-party organization that would combine students from a bunch of different districts and open up a classroom within one of those school districts, one of those public schools. But the classroom was a county program. So we were still within a school campus, a public school campus, but we really did not belong to that particular school district. We had students from other school districts. And we also had site-based centers, or centers exclusively for students, you know, with autism diagnoses or students with orthopedic impairments. There were some sites that were specific to their disability categories, medically fragile programs. So I worked there for 5 years in the beginning, you know, traditional OT practice, going from different schools, helping students in that classroom meet their IEP goals. But there were many incidences, I should say, that sort of set a light bulb going for me. Some of the teachers would have this inclusion time where they would have kids from gen ed come into our classrooms and, you know, hang out with our kiddos. And, you know, we would have these inclusion days and inclusion times, inclusion activities. Oh, it's inclusion time for this kid. They have to be taken to that particular PE session, whatever, and brought back. So one interesting story that I like to share is when one of the teachers would invite kids from fourth and fifth grade to come into our K-2 self-contained, we call them SDCs or special day class in California, to come into our classrooms. And the kids hung out with our little kids with disabilities. And there was one student who was just enamored by these girls who would come in from fourth grade, and he would follow them. And he just loved interacting with these kids who were sort of giving him a lot of attention and, you know, just enjoying their company. And we've been working with the student. I had been serving the student for a long time, from all the way from preschool, and he'd come a long way from not wanting to touch anything to, not even walking at that point when he started with us. And he'd come a long way. There was one thing we still were struggling with, helping him to feed himself. He just refused to feed himself. There really wasn't any physical, you know, limitation with feeding himself, but he just waited for somebody to feed him. So one day these girls from fourth grade came in and sat with him and looked at him and like, "Hey, Jimmy," his name is not Jimmy, I'm just saying, "Jimmy, I have yogurt too. Let's eat." And he was like, "Oh yeah, let's eat." And he sits with these girls and starts feeding himself like he's been doing it forever. That was like, oh my gosh, all it took was that social context for him to be with his peers to just start feeding himself. He just wanted to impress them, I suppose, or just wanted to feel he was part of that group. So that really opened my eyes. And after that incident, I should say that I started noticing this more and more and more. There were times when, in the presence of their peers, our kiddos did so much better or seemed so much more engaged in activities. And so I started looking into involving kids without disabilities in my session, in my OT session. And I really didn't know a lot about inclusion at that point. But sort of organically, I realized that this is so much more impactful than any other traditional OT approaches that I have been using in the past. Just having that peer support, peer relationships can make a huge difference for my students. So that sort of became my focus. And I started doing programs within the middle school campus, where that's when the segregation sort of becomes wider and our kids hardly ever had any time with their peers. So I collaborated with the Gen Ed leadership elective teacher, and we had ongoing programs where the kids would come to our program and we would have gardening activities going on and, you know, a lot of things. So our team and the Gen Ed team collaborated and did stuff, and it was probably the most fulfilling part of my job, was beyond working on, you know, traditional therapy. This just made so much more impact. And it so truly represented who I am as an occupational therapist. So I felt this is where I want to focus my attention on. And I just became obsessed with that space, I should say. And at that point, I only thought about social inclusion. And I said, okay, I want to go explore further. I want to investigate the space more, and started my PhD journey in occupational therapy at Texas Women's University, only to find out that our literature is so limited in this space, in inclusive participation. And so I really had to jump into the education literature to enhance my knowledge. And starting off with social inclusion, I evolved, I should say, very soon to understand that you cannot separate social and academic inclusion. Even the very definition of social inclusion involves interpersonal relationships and community participation. And what is community participation in a school? Being able to access all that students without disabilities are able to access as well, right? So they just cannot be separated. So that sort of set me on this path of exploring inclusion and making that happen in the lives of the students that we serve in schools.
And you were working in this county setting, you said, for 5 years?
For 13 years. So the first 5 years were sort of where I think realized that this is important. Mm. The next 5 years, I should say, the next 8 years was all about me trying to make that more of a focus for in my practice.
Gotcha. Yeah. I am familiar with the county programs work in California, because I taught in Pasadena Unified in California, and we had a very similar system of the county, like Los Angeles County Office of Education, would have classrooms in schools that were in the vicinity of or within the perimeter of the county. And then there were county schools, like you said, like it was special schools. Oh, and I don't think I've ever told you this, but when I was going to Cal State Fullerton for my teacher ed program, we went to a quote unquote inclusive school. And this was like the best in the area, essentially. I don't even remember the name of the school, but I mean, it was fully inclusive. Okay, it was. But then I don't know who asked. I might have asked. Somebody else might have asked. I don't remember. Be like, where are the kids with? And we didn't have this. We didn't have extensive support needs. Like that wasn't the language. We used something else. We're like, where are those? Where are the other kids? And they're like, oh, they don't go here.
That's right. Yeah.
They go somewhere else. And it's like, okay.
Exactly. And it was interesting because I had never worked in any other set. Well, I did sort of worked a little bit in the district before I started with the county. But for the longest time, I only served kids with the most significant support needs that I didn't know how else. And then the county office had an inclusion collaborative department that supported districts in enabling inclusive settings. So which was sort of, you know, ironic that we had our own exclusive programs when we were supporting inclusion in the districts. So while completely turning a blind eye to this population of students, we had in 500 school sites, 500 classrooms, who just had absolutely no inclusion time or very minimal inclusion time. And what people perceived as inclusion was also very different from school to school and person to person. I mean, personally, I would have answered differently if you had asked me that whether your school is inclusive or not. If you had asked me like 13 years ago, like, of course, we're very inclusive. We have all these programs where we facilitate inclusion for our students. But no, I know better now. I have to do better now. So, yeah. And the literature just like, why aren't we doing this if this is so clear and it's been around for 30 years, more than 30 years, that kids do academically, socially, and in, you know, long-term outcome-wise, better when they're in inclusive settings. And the limitation has nothing to do with student needs. The barrier has nothing to do with student needs. It's more to do with our mindset and capacity factors. So that's where we need to be focusing our attention on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the thing that really changed your mind? Because you mentioned at the beginning that the story of including Jimmy, right? Or having Jimmy be in a place where he was with typically developing peers and then in seeing so clearly the benefit of that. Was there like in in your definition of inclusion and how you would describe inclusion or inclusive education now, was there a moment where it all kind of clicked for you, like your understanding of it, of how you would describe it now?
I have to say it evolved slowly. It didn't click. I had mm-hmm. different clicking moments, I think. It was like, oh, with peers, kids do so much better. And next is like, oh, we have to intentionally facilitate this. It cannot, you know, we cannot just throw kids in gen ed and say, here we are. Oh, we have inclusive recess. We have inclusive assemblies. That's not inclusive. That's just physical space sharing. Inclusion takes intentional effort. So we have to facilitate that and make it happen. And then I also felt like, oh, it's not realistic. It's not very sensible to have kids with such significant cognitive differences to be educated in a general education classroom. It doesn't make very much sense to, like, of course, compared to being in a self-contained to a general education setting, they're learning a lot. We're just measuring different things, right? So if we were to measure what's more important for our students in 21st century, we obviously will find that kids gain a lot in a general education classroom, regardless of the nature of their disabilities. Just so many of those with readings, with listening to your podcast and you know, delving into the literature and all, you know, brooding over these questions and having conversations with people are in the space. I think that I've had several eye-opening moments. And I have to say that at this point, where I am in my PhD program, I'm a PhD candidate now, I'm just about to get my dissertation started. I feel like things have come together, and I feel like I'm in a place at this time where I'm clear that my focus going forward is to ensure that my profession in school plays a powerful role in enabling inclusive participation for students with disabilities, especially students with extensive support needs. And, you know, it's kind of, so through over the course of my PhD program, I did two studies. The first study was, like I said, I started off with social inclusion, right? So I wanted to find out what do schools do to facilitate social inclusion, since there's absolutely zero literature in OT and on social inclusion for students with extensive support needs. I want to look at what do schools do to facilitate social inclusion for students with extensive. So I looked into the literature. I did a scoping review. And I found that, so I specifically looked at studies that addressed social element of inclusion. So I found that the number one was peer-mediated interventions. The number one intervention used is peer-mediated interventions. And then it comes to school-wide comprehensive efforts. And then collaboration.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Could you explain what that means or looks like, just in case somebody hears peer-mediated interventions and doesn't know what that means?
So peer-mediated interventions is where we involve peers without disabilities to enable inclusion, to be agents of inclusion for students with extensive support needs. So there are different types of peer-mediated interventions. And I think if you go to Dr. Carter's website, you can find a lot of resources. And also the TAI Center has some really great resources on peer-mediated interventions. So we have peer support programs, peer partner programs, and peer network interventions. So they're like slightly different. Peer support is where you have a student with a disability and a student without disability specifically working on certain goals, addressing certain goals, whereas peer networks is creating a community for a student who has significant support needs with other peers who can sort of help them integrate into the school, the school social space. Mm-hmm. So that would be peer network. And they do activities outside. And again, peer partner programs are programs where, again, they partner with peers and they have like programs like Best Buddies, I think, would come under peer mm-hmm. partner programs. So all of these are efforts that we're making, although it's not the whole thing. They're little efforts that we're making to invite students with disabilities who have historically been outside or on the margins of our society into our spaces. But that's not enough. That's not it. That's not inclusion itself. It's just a pathway towards getting there, because our systems have been this way forever. So to change that, mm-hmm. it takes time. But we never should be satisfied and say like, oh, we're inclusive, we're there. No, it's a journey. Inclusion is a journey. And I also have come to understand, so I have inclusion, there's like authentic inclusion, right? So authentic inclusion takes active effort to combat exclusion. That's what authentic inclusion is. It is beyond physical placement. It takes intentional effort, and it addresses all three dimensions of inclusion, which is the physical, academic, and the social dimension. So an authentic inclusion is a journey forever, always trying to combat exclusion.
Yeah. I know some people don't like to hear that, you know, like they don't like to hear that it takes time, because they want it now. And I get it. I get that we want it now. And I also get that, you know, best buddies, and then, you know, put whatever sort of synonym to best buddies. So there's lots of different kinds of programs out there that, that facilitate, hopefully authentic friendships, that isn't inclusion. I think it's difficult because, you know, for people who have been advocating for authentic inclusive education for so long, and then seeing, programs highlighted in a positive note, either in the media or someone just talking to you, you don't want to completely be like, well, that's not inclusion, you know, like, you know, like have this attitude of, like that isn't real, you know, because the thing is like, it's real for the kids that are involved with the friendships, you know what I mean? Even though it may not be perfect, right?
Exactly. And I think we should never become paralyzed by this analysis of like, what is the right thing to do? And then we never do anything.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So that is worse than doing something wrong, I think, at some times. I mean, there are no literal like absolutes anywhere. So when we have the intention of creating better engagement and participation for our students, then we take efforts. And when we take efforts, we learn as we grow. Like, this is good, but of course I want to do even better. So if we never get to doing something that we think is right, we'll never learn to do, to get that, make that better. Right. So
Exactly.
I think the intention is very important. And with the intention, the effort to do the right thing and being open to learn and grow along the way is key.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I love the lens that you're looking at this with, specifically occupational therapy. I worked in public schools for a while, and I've known lots of occupational therapists, And I have always felt that OTs have, I don't know, they were like the easiest to get on board with.
Why am like I not thinking, surprised?
Like thinking inclusively, you know, like SLPs are wonderful, like speech language pathologists are wonderful people. And I'm so glad that they're part of the school system and that they're part of like related services, you know. But for some reason, occupational therapists, I could always be like, hey, I've got this wild idea. What if we, and then, you know, and they're always like, yeah, let's do it. So I'm wondering, like, why do you think that is?
Because we were born to do that. We were trained and designed. We were manufactured to do that, basically. You know, it's so another aha moment for me was we always have a difficulty articulating what we do, right? That's the nature. It's both the boon and the bane of our profession, I should say, that occupational therapy cannot be put into, isolated into, stepped into, or it cannot be boxed into these specific roles. Because we are, the way occupational therapy is defined is, it is defined as the therapeutic use of everyday life activities to enhance participation. Enhance or enable participation. So something as broad as that, you cannot, it's an administrative nightmare to use somebody with such a broad scope of practice, right? And even for us to explain, what do? We enable participation in life's occupations. And I'd be like, what do you mean? So we're constantly being misunderstood and misrepresented all over the place. And so we are siloed into these areas. Okay, OT, here you go. Work on fine and gross motor section. Here you go. Work on sensory areas. But that's not all we do. Our background was never, we never had handwriting training in school, like zero. And like 90% of our referrals are for handwriting in most schools. Sensory integration is an area that an occupational therapist heavily researched in. And so that's sort of become a big element of our scope or of our many tools that we use. But that's just another tool we use to increase participation in life's occupations. And in school-based practice, education is the main occupation of a student. And in education comes all the other occupations that are integral to a success, to the success of a student. That is, self-care is an occupation, social participation is an occupation. All of these occupations are integral to playing the role of a student effectively, right? So that is our scope. So it always frustrates us, occupational therapists, like, we're not handwriting teachers. We're not sensory therapists. We're not like motor therapists. Who are you then? And I think the best definition is that I can think of, the best role that we can embrace in school is inclusion therapists, right? Inclusion specialists. That is just so representative of who we are, as best as it can be representative of who we are, because we're going to enable participation in the least restrictive environment, right? So again, that's another. So that's one thing. So occupational therapy, our training is basically in enabling participation, and participation we see as involving these three main dimensions. One is the person who's participating, the context of the environment in which they're participating, and the occupation or the activity that they're doing. Okay, I would say. So these three are like the main components for successful participation. Okay, and our training is in understanding the person, all different aspects, the physical, the psychosocial elements of a person. And then we understand the context, the physical context and the physical environment and the social environment. Then we study occupations in depth. We understand how we can break down activities and understand it in depth. So with all of this training and the dynamic relationship between these three components, I think we have some pretty great perspectives about how we can meaningfully enable inclusion in schools. So, right, we know that if you have a student with extensive support needs in a general education classroom without making any accommodations or making any modifications to the physical or the social environment, you're not really doing inclusion there. You're actually facilitating exclusion in some way. Like, why do I want to be here if nobody wants me here or nobody's doing anything to make it accessible for me? So you need to bring in an OT here to make it accessible for this student, right? So it takes a team effort, and OTs can be very powerful supports in that space. I doubt as many administrators know that this is what OTs do. This is what we are trained in.
Yeah, it sounds like the districts need to utilize OTs more in this like inclusion facilitator role. Some districts have a role called an inclusion facilitator, and they're mostly like, you know, teachers on special assignment where they don't have a classroom, but they're still like technically a teacher, like on paper. And then they help facilitate, or they have some sort of administrative credential, and they, you know, they help with planning and they help with collaboration. It's really interesting. And also your comment about, you know, OTs mostly being used as handwriting. Like, I know that I don't want to be too cynical, but I feel like that is right on point with how OTs are typically used, right? And handwriting is such a that's a whole other topic, whether or not we should be working on handwriting anyways with technology and everything, but you know, anyways, we don't have to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's 21st century and we have very many concerns, and I think they want OT services for a student. And the only way they believe they can get OT services for a student is to find an area of deficit, and handwriting stands as an area of functional deficit, and then therefore gets referred, or writing is a big area that OTs are called to support. Yeah. And it's not just handwriting, you know, you're working on technology for expressive communication, all that sort of falls under that, but that's not the only thing. There's much more to it.
Yeah. I mean, like, I just, the feeding too, you know, the feeding and the self-care that takes up a lot of minutes on IEPs. And so I'm wondering though, like, let's say I'm an administrator and I'm having an aha moment and the light bulbs are going off and I'm like, oh my goodness, I can utilize my OTs differently. What does that even look like in the IEP? Like, how would a team describe or characterize a service like that? You know, given some new information about like what OTs do.
Tim, I think that's a very, very good question and a very important question. And it does not have an easy answer. One thing I do want to bring to attention is we have this very clear statement that a student can be removed from general education if and only if, with the use of supplementary aids and services, the student is unable to benefit from or unable to learn in the general education environment. Can a student be moved to outside the general education environment, right? So what are supplementary aids and services? So they are supports and services that enable a child to access general education environments. That's what supplementary aids and services are. And IDEA does not specify what those services are. It's a list, a never-ending list of services and aids. So OTs can be used as supplementary services. We don't have to be used only as related services where we are in the IEPs that many number of minutes, but we can be listed as supplementary services to enable, to help with accessing, say, science lessons. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in addition to the special educator, there is an OT coming in and helping the teacher adapt science lessons in a way that's meaningful for that student, and oftentimes for the whole classroom, for students with a range of abilities to maximize their learning. what a powerful indigenous resource you have in your school if you put OT as a supplementary service there, right? And also you can, when you write your goals, of course, every school has different customary practices of how they write goals. You don't have to delegate OT goals. The team sits together and makes these goals. And the framework with which you see the students' goals is, if you're looking at the goals as a way to enable access in general education environments, like you're putting goals where the student will learn, say, math concepts or fractions in a general education setting, then the OT can be added on in that goal. The speech therapist can be added on. So they can support multiple goals. And the service, the intervention that an OT provides, does not have to be a one-on-one pull-out service, right? The service can be provided over a spectrum of individual, group, consultation, all of those things that can help this child maximize their learning to meet those IEP goals. So I think it's a mindset change for administrators and OTs and teachers to view these services as very helpful in making access to general education possible. So with that mindset, you can creatively rewrite the service delivery language. How do you articulate the services? So again, it varies from state to state. In California, people specify this many number of minutes in such a specific place, either individually or in a group setting. But you want to look further and see, is this a legal mandate or is this just a customary practice in your school?
Oh, yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah, that's something to look into, because it's not, the federal law does not require you to specify whether it's individual or group. It requires you to specify the location of services. In Texas, though, in one of the school districts, they always wrote it would be provided over on so many minutes a year over a period of, so many minutes a quarter or so many minutes a month, depending on that student and that team. But with the possibility of providing either individual, group, or consultation over a spectrum on whatever is necessary for the student.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I just remember being in IEP meetings and it's like, okay, this student is getting 60 minutes per month of OT consultation, but the OT is in my classroom twice a week, so they're essentially getting more, but the way that you're putting it on paper is, it's just so confusing. it's so confusing. And then the other thing, I don't know if they have this in Texas, but when I taught in Georgia, this is the way that it was. They had a rubric about, and based on how many years of service the student received, let's say if the student received 5, years of OT service, then the team could possibly say, well, we've been providing this level of service for X amount of years, so providing service at the same level is not providing benefit. So therefore, we're reducing the amount of service. It was wild.
Yeah, it happens in many places. So the justification for service delivery is also so weird. Because you say, oh, the kid has not made progress and therefore no OT is needed. Or the kid really needs to make progress and therefore we give more OT services. So the same, the reason is used to justify both removing service and adding on service. And that's right. Very short-sighted, I think. If an OT does not end, if you're only working on handwriting and say, okay, the kid has, we've tried 5 years, we've tried to write his name and he hasn't learned to write his name. And therefore, now we're going to dismiss OT services. So that just reinforces to the team that OTs only work on handwriting.
Right.
But if you were to say, okay, if the OT scope is to enable maximized participation in a lesser restrictive environment, then it opens up a whole big scope for an OT to support, to stay in the system and to stay within the IEP team in creative ways. One example is just making resources accessible for students, not just physically, but socially accessible. It takes somebody designing games that would work for students with and without disabilities to play together. Take cafeteria. If you were to make cafeteria accessible for our students, how can you not have just kids from self-contained sitting in one corner of the room? How can you have kids mingle? How can you creatively design, you know, eating activities? You know, oh, let's do food tasting today. So once a week, and it's not just kids with disabilities. Kids with autism are always pointed out as saying, oh, they're very sensitive to foods. But there are a lot of kids who do not have a diagnosis of autism, who have very limited food choices. So that can be a great opportunity. Like, we're going to work on improving our food, you know, healthy food choices, and then have kids taste foods. That creates a room for inclusion. You can, you know, all the idiosyncrasies of our kiddos will come out and facilitate engagement and participation. Same with, you know, you could just teach fraction with an apple in the class. Creatively design a lesson with an OT and a teacher can work together to creatively design a lesson where our kids can have more ambitious goals in their IEP. Right?
Goes all great. Through the school. These all are great examples. Yes. Great examples. And I hope people that are listening can start to think creatively about how to use OTs, or at least have a conversation with the OT that you know is at their school or, you know, is supporting. Because again, going back to my comment about OTs, were always the ones who were had an open mind with how to include learners, and I'm so appreciative. I so appreciate that about them. And from talking with you, it seems like, you know, it is part of the training. You know, it is part of the training in being an OT. And no one's ever explained occupational therapists or therapy the way that you have to me. So I am learning a lot.
Oh, and I was talking about the two studies I did in my PhD. The one was the scoping review. And again, the scoping review had no mention of any OT or any SLP involved in that inclusion process, but that's something else. The other study I did was a survey of OTs and special ed teachers who work with students with extensive support needs. And I wanted to know what percentage of an OT's caseload involves students with extensive support needs. We don't have that data, right? Mm,
yeah.
So students with extensive support needs are probably 1% of the school student population, right? About 1-2% of student population. So looking at an OT's caseload, so I first did an interest survey on Facebook. I just been to a bunch of Facebook, school-based OT Facebook groups, and I said, I just want to know what percentage of your caseload involves students with extensive support needs. Was a one-question survey, very easy for people to fill. And I got 186 responses in 3 days.
And that's good.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the finding was at least more than 50% of OTs said that at least 40% of their caseload involved students with extensive support needs.
Wow. Wow.
And then I did an IRB approved formal survey, and I had about 130 responses from OTs. I eliminated some of them, but the same exact same result was there too. At least 50% of OTs said that, more than 50% OTs said that at least 40% of their caseload involved students with extensive support needs. And every time I do a presentation in a conference, just out of curiosity, I put that question out there and I keep getting the same result. So, I mean, OTs work in different school districts, and sometimes the justification is, oh, they're too severe to benefit from OT services. Or others, in other settings, it's like, oh, they really need OT services. So the reasoning is so different. However, it sounds like majority of us support a significant number of students with extensive support needs. And the next question was, what do you work on with these students? And of course, the responses was handwriting, self-care, sensory regulation, fine motor skills. the typical one. How do they lead to inclusion as an outcome? Like, what is the purpose of working on handwriting for many years or working on buttoning your shirt for many years? That does not take the expertise of a doctoral level. You know, right now, majority of the OT programs are entry-level doctorates. So students finish their bachelor's and go through a three-year doctoral program, and they come with so much passion. So I have been teaching for the past 3 years in Texas Women's University, and the students are amazing. The amount of passion they come with to change the world, you know, to make an impact in the society, you know, and to take all of these human potential and reduce it down to, like, you know, playing whack-a-mole and in school, knocking off IEP mandates, you know, oh, here's an eval, put that down. Here's another eval, put that down. And that's not what we went to school for. They can do a lot more.
Oh my goodness.
So
this is so good. Wow. I need a second. I'm literally replaying all of the OTs and like IEPs I've ever had. And every time an OT has been in my classroom, going, man, all the training and effort and the passion, like you said, and them being relegated to certain kinds of activities and like being pigeonholed, essentially. Exactly. You know,
so to do buttons you don't need a lot of OT support time, right? So you can always justify reducing OT time because you're only working on buttoning, and you know, the classroom can do that. You're just working on self-feeding, and it cannot be taught in one session. It has to be done every single day. And I've already trained the staff, so OT services are dismissed for the student.
Right.
Oh, handwriting, well, he's tried enough. It's not at his level anymore.
So Savitha, what should it look like going forward? Like, if you had a magic wand and you could change, like, how OTs are utilized either in school or how, you know, maybe just how people view OTs, like, what is your vision going forward?
If I had a magic wand, I couldn't have anything overnight. Part of me wants to say, I think the admins have to take a stand that OTs will stop addressing handwriting skills in schools. Or at least, you know, it's not that they should not. I know they have a lot of expertise, but I think putting them in that fine motor box and relegating them to that role is very severely limiting. And I think OT should be given a time outside of IEP mandated services. So if a therapist has 30 students or 60 students in their caseload, then the time of their work, their work time is calculated based on how many students they support. We must allocate a considerable amount of time in an OT's workload to support systems, to support schools, to support classrooms, and that will significantly reduce the number of unnecessary referrals. You wouldn't have handwriting referrals if the therapist and the teacher has had a discussion and the teacher has been taught some techniques and say, okay, these are some things that you can universally use with all students. There are programs out there that you can avail and you know, use it for all of your class. There's no systematic handwriting instruction going on in many schools because it is not perceived as something important. But for a kid who has a disability, who's already struggling with several, you know, challenges, you're micro-focusing on another area of challenge and forcing the kid and showing them over and over again what they're not good at is, I think, detrimental to a student's learning. Instead, if you can make you can use an OT to create UDL in the class. Like, you know, how can kids either speak out their answers or use a partner assisted way of expressing their learning, you know, have all these options available for all students. Then I think, you know, you're using your OT better in the system and use them as supplementary services and also related services. So that also opens up, give them a lot of time to provide universal supports for the classrooms, the schools they serve, and use OTs also to write goals in the IEP that will enable a student have access to more general education environments. If the student is only doing assembly, you can start off with even just assembly, but the OT's intervention goes into making that assembly accessible and meaningful for the student. So that way you're helping a whole variety of students, right? You cannot support a student by just directly working with a student. You have to support the student by working on the activity and the environment along with the students.
This is fantastic, Savitha. Thank you so much for sharing your vision. Do you have any final thoughts to share with our listeners, educators, principals, parents, whoever? What's on your mind for the last few minutes?
I think I shared most of it, but just to summarize as a takeaway, I just want to say that schools, you have some very, very resourceful indigenous supports in OTs in your school. So take advantage of them and remove and stop viewing OTs as these motor specialists or handwriting specialists, and view them more as participation specialists. And then that would help you use their expertise in more meaningful ways that's more relevant to 21st century needs. And OTs are also mental health professionals. So that's a huge area. So I think what's unique about OT is we understand the body-mind relationship more, more than most other professionals, because that's where our training is. You know, we've had intense training in anatomy and physiology and development and medicine and you know, pathology and all of those things, that we have a sound knowledge in that. We also learn psychiatry. We understand mental health in depth, and all with the outcome of how can we integrate it to enable access and participation. So if you understand that, then I think you definitely can use OTs in very creative ways in your systems.
I like that, participation specialists. That's good.
Yeah, you can call it participation specialists, inclusion specialists, accessibility specialists, but not motor specialists or sensory specialists. That's just one of the many tools we use to enable participation.
When we return, the mystery question.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
All right, mystery question time. All right, let's see if it's a good one. Okay. What do you feel people complain too much about these days?
What do people complain? I can tell
what do people complain about? Yeah. That might be, yeah. What do you complain about too much these days?
It's just not enough time. I think I say that a lot, and I hear people say, there's just not enough time to do all that I want to do or to do all that I need to do.
That's relatable. That is relatable. Yeah. I was thinking this is so basic, but I went to the grocery store the other day for we were making Cuban sandwiches. Okay. So like we have this Cuban sandwich recipe and like slow roast the pork and stuff. It's like so good, right? But we needed chips. So I went to the store to get chips. Oh my gosh. My wife does the grocery shopping, so like I don't always see how much things are. But I'm like, are you kidding me? Like it seems such like a silly thing to complain about, you know, especially in this like climate in our country where everyone is complaining about inflation. But like I definitely was like complaining about it in my mind, at least. I'm like, I cannot believe I'm paying this much for potato chips, but
I hear you. I you know, it's so funny. I just think about the time when I was a student. When I came from India in 2001 as a student. You can cut it off if this is totally irrelevant.
No, yeah.
When I came as a student, you know, things are very different now. You know, the world is more much closer than it was back then. And my roommates and I would go shopping, and everything we would multiply by 50. And like a yogurt costs like $1.5, and that times 50, 75 rupees for a box of yogurt. We don't need to eat the yogurt. We go on to the next item. And we were like, for the first 2 weeks we were here, we were like, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. There's no way we're going to be spending so much for basic essentials in our,
I know, right?
For our lives. And then now the whole idea of like money, it's just, we've come too far. And, you know, I don't know. I quit bothering about how things are like so outrageously priced.
Yeah, I know. And I don't even live in California anymore. Like when we go back home to visit, the, you know, gas prices and then just like going out to eat or, you know, the grocery store, it's just like it's mind-boggling. So anyways, you know, and this is like a completely like value free conversation. Like I don't have any axe to grind like with any particular group or person. It just is what it is. Savitha Sundar, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tim. This was fun.
That chime means it's free time. And this week, it's time to dip into the mailbag. Okay, it's just the email inbox, but it sounds cooler if you think of it as a bag. Here we go. This message is from Karen. Thanks for your article about what inclusion is not. What is your view on kids with disabilities attending Special Olympics? Oh, wow. Thanks for asking, Karen. I do have some thoughts about Special Olympics. And if you want to read the article she is referring to, we will link it in the show notes. To put it very simply, I don't love it. I put Special Olympics in the same category as programs like Helping Hands and Best Buddies, which, in my opinion, aren't shining examples of authentic inclusion. I think it probably depends on the program, but it is very easy for a helper-helpee dynamic to be present. And I don't think that moves us closer to what we want. Ultimately, we have to ask ourselves, are these types of programs going to change schools to be more inclusive at the system level? And I'm just not sure that they are. But I am going to throw a slight wrinkle in for all of us to think about. While I'm not a huge fan of programs like Special Olympics, Unified Sports, Best Buddies, The Sparkle Effect, and other programs that bring people with and without disabilities together, I cannot deny that many disabled people love them, partly because there are so
few places for them to feel included. So, are these programs perfect? No. Are they beneficial? I think they are. But do they move us forward to fully inclusive schools? I haven't seen that they do. Not yet, anyways. That's it for this episode of Think Inclusive. I'd love to know what you thought about this episode or any episode. Feel free to email me at tviellegas@mcie.org. That's tviellegas@mcie.org. Or find us on the socials at think_inclusive. We are at that handle pretty much everywhere. Think Inclusive is written, edited, designed, mixed, and mastered by me, Tim Viegas, and is a production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education. Learn more about who we are, what we do, and how you can become a partner at mcie.org. Thanks to the Autism Society for being our sponsor this week. Learn more at autismsociety.org. Original music by Miles Kredich. Additional music from Melody. That's MELOD.IE. Thanks for your time and attention. And remember, inclusion always works. When I was preparing to send you questions, I was like, where are the notes? And I couldn't find them. So this is the best that I could off the top of my head.
That's okay. We'll just chat and we'll see where it goes. Yeah, I don't have everything sort of clearly outlined either. So I'm just going to speak from.
Yeah, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. Okay. So are you ready? And we'll just jump in.
Sure.
All right.
From MCIE.